Hello, and welcome to Looking to Score, the podcast where we geek out about movie scores, their composers, and everything else in between. I'm Brian Brennan, and joining me, as always, is the 100-year-old man who climbed out the window and disappeared, Brett Blake. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Hopefully not quite that old, but but sure, I'll take it.
All right, today we are featuring renowned composer, multiple Oscar nominee, never winner, Thomas Newman.
That's right.
Featuring his use of atmosphere and texture versus theme. But before we get into that, we want to bring you our pre-show picks where we talk about what we're listening to as of late. So Brett, kick us off. What are you listening to?
All right. So there's a new John Williams score out at this point, and it's for Steven Spielberg's movie, The Fabelmans. And I wanted to touch on this score particularly right now because it, spoiler alert, it is probably not going to feature on my favorite scores of the year list. This is a weird one because the album only features about 20-ish minutes of score. And apparently that's all that Williams wrote for the movie. So it's primarily one major theme, which is a very nice theme. And it's explored a little bit on the album. But it's a lot of very kind of moody, not atonal, but athematic scoring underneath that. It's pleasant. It's not like a dark score by any means, but it is certainly not one that I'm going to be returning to all that frequently, probably.
Yeah, he tends to use a lot of, classical pieces throughout. I don't know. It seems like he's adding a buffer with some of those existing pieces, but I don't know.
That's right. Yeah, the album includes some classical stuff. And having not seen the movie, I'm sure there's probably a reason for that.
Right.
But it's just kind of an odd album. And it's odd that a movie that I've heard is like 2 hours and 20 some minutes only has 20 some minutes of John Williams' score. But I guess maybe I'll reserve final judgment until I hear how it's used in the movie. It's not bad by any means, but it didn't knock me out immediately.
All right. I am listening to a score that eluded me from 2020, and it is Tales from the Loop by Philip Glass and Paul Leonard Morgan. And the score has a calming feel to it with Glass's familiar repetitive motifs and the use of piano and cello throughout. So it's a nice collaborative score on the part of these two composers. And it's just one of those scores that you can, you know, turn on in the background while you're working. I'm a big fan of those kinds of scores. So sure. Definitely check out Tales from the Loop. All right, here we go. On to the good stuff. Thomas Newman, the most famous of the Newmans?
Well, I think certainly currently. but it's interesting you say that. The Newmans. We wanted to sort of briefly put him in context with the rest of his family because he is part of a film score dynasty to a certain extent. His father was Alfred Newman, a very legendary Hollywood composer, composed the scores to many films, probably most known to most people for the 20th Century Fox fanfare. Mm-hmm. His uncle is Lionel Newman, who primarily was known more for being a conductor and an orchestrator. And then David Newman is a composer who's still working. That's Thomas Newman's brother. And then their cousin is the wonderful Randy Newman of such fame from The Natural and the Toy Story movies and Seabiscuit and a bunch of other stuff.
It's interesting because Newman himself, or Thomas Newman, I should say.
Yeah, which Newman?
stated that he's not really a fanboy of movie scores and that he's never really, like, he's not really familiar with a lot of his father's scores. Like, he doesn't just go in and listen to those scores. So that's kind of strange, but, you know.
And that's interesting. And you don't hear much of his father's sound in any of his own work. Now, obviously, Alfred Newman was working at a much different era for film scoring than when Thomas Newman even began. And certainly, you know, than what it's like now. So you wouldn't necessarily think that there'd be a ton of overlap between what his father did and what he's done. but you definitely do not hear much of a familial influence there. And just a couple early points of trivia talking about how he sort of developed. Clearly, when your father and uncle are well-known players in that arena, you are going to have sort of a foot in the door if you want it. So that certainly helped him as he began sort of his career. I found online, and I didn't see any backup for this, so this could be entirely apocryphal, who knows, but it was mentioned that he was mentored by Stephen Sondheim, sort of the icon of musical theater.
Yeah.
Have you heard that elsewhere?
Yeah, I have a quote from him, actually. And I don't know if you came across this either, but I forget where they kind of met, if it was at like a university situation or whatever, but I'll give a quote here. He listened to things I had to say as if what I had to say had some interest, and I don't think I'd ever been spoken to in that way before, and he was very open about process and collaboration in a way that he was not afraid to share vulnerability with me as a matter of what it meant to be collaborative. So I think I learned basic lessons in how humans interact.
That's
sounds like very characteristic of Sondheim when he's wearing his mentor hat.
Well, speaking of process and collaboration, one thing we do know definitively is that Thomas Newman ended up on sort of John Williams's staff, if you will, as Williams was writing Return of the Jedi in 1983, and Newman was brought on as an orchestrator. Now, the orchestration process can vary from composer to composer. With Williams, it's sort of very specific. Generally, the job of an orchestrator is to take the rough ideas that the composer has in place for a cue and then flesh it out with all the various sections of the orchestra. And depending on who you're working with, you will have more freedom than not, depending on who you're working with. So in the case of Williams, he is very much driving every aspect of the orchestration process. So he knows what he wants every section of the orchestra to be doing at any given moment. And the orchestration for him is really just more a matter of having extra hands to physically write out all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So Newman wasn't necessarily, you know, he didn't have leeway here to sort of do any of his own creative stuff on Return of the Jedi. He was kind of just dictating and transcribing based on what Williams was laying out. But we do know definitively that one of the cues that he orchestrated is the Darth Vader's death cue. So I thought it might be fun if we just listen to a little bit of that cue. And here it is right now.
Very non-Newman-y, I guess.
Yeah, it's clearly Williams. But, you know, there's some high string stuff that maybe if you you know, squint your eyes and tilt your head, you look at it a certain way, you could say, well, maybe he drew on, I'm sure he drew on stuff he learned from working with John Williams. I think anybody would. So there's certainly that.
So that being said, I think Newman is mostly recognized for his quote unquote sound. And I guess we want to pick apart, you know, what is his most definable sound?
Yeah.
Before we get into that, I kind of wanted to share another quote from an interview with him. And he says, a lot of my music tends to be patterned and repeating. So oftentimes I'll get together with percussionists or guitarists who can take these patterns and add to them and therefore make them more sonically interesting. If you have repeating phrases, oftentimes it'll allow the ear then to hear colors in a way that widens your perception of sound and music and how it comes at you. So his sound is definitely more eclectic. I think sometimes anachronistic as far as instrumentation goes. You know, most of the time he'll use solo piano, solo woodwinds, or oboe. And to give you an idea of the sorts of instruments he uses, here's just a few from the liner notes of the Road to Perdition soundtrack, which I'm going to highlight next. And apologies if I get these wrong. I'm sure they're Gaelic in nature, which I am not going
to
pronounce.
It's easy to pronounce, right? It's all easy,
so
right?
Easy. All right, so there's the low and high whistle, Damore, low D penny whistle, Iwi, Irish bouzouki, bowed string drum, found metal, wands, panglocken, bowed sustains, guitar with glass, metal, sponge. So that's just a few interesting instruments.
That's like the instrumentation equivalent of a garage sale. It's just like, what do I have on hand that's unusual? I'm going to use it.
And I think I feel like he might be in that mindset where, you know, I'm going to take these found instruments and work them into my score somehow.
Yeah. And I think usually it works. Like usually he doesn't go so far that it becomes like just ridiculous nonsense. Like he's not just doing stuff just to do it. There's always a rationale for the choices that he's making. I just wanted to add that when we're talking about his sound, I think he's got a style that is actually sort of difficult to pin down or explain, despite the fact that it's very distinct.
Mm-hmm.
It's more the kind of thing that you just have to hear a couple pieces from him and you'll be able to go, okay, I get it, versus actually trying to verbally explain exactly what his technique is, because it's the eclectic nature of it is just sometimes hard to put into words.
Yeah, so this first one, I kind of want to highlight the anachronistic elements of his work. This is Road to Perdition from 2002, and the cue is called Meet McGuire. And Road to Perdition takes place in the early 30s, and what you hear in this piece is kind of a far cry from 1930s music or atmosphere. But first, Newman uses pizzicato strings and percussion to give this kind of creeping tempo, and then either a clarinet or an oboe gives off this really twisted and almost sultry feeling, which accompanies the bizarre scene in the movie, very fittingly.
Thank you.
All right, another aspect of his work is just, like we said, the use of eclectic instruments. The cue I want to highlight here is from 1999's American Beauty. The cue is called Root Beer, and this is an example of using that metallic percussion that he sometimes employs in his work, and a very frantic off-kilter rhythm that kind of suggests how flustered the main character is in this scene in the film. So here is Root Beer. And then just another example of kind of some more interesting eclectic instruments here. It's hard to discern what instruments are being used here, but it's almost electronic in nature, kind of vibe-like.
Synthetic.
Yeah, and this is from Jarhead, and the cue is called Raining Oil.
I'd actually never heard any of the Jarhead score before you actually selected this cue to talk about. And I'm intrigued, so I'm going to have to listen to more of this one.
Yeah, it's interesting. It kind of grows on you after a while, I would say. Then another aspect, or a few aspects of his work, is the progression of chords, sustained notes, and repetition. Repetition, which he does point out happens a lot in his music. And this is another example from American Beauty called Dead Already. And it's just an example of how he builds on a repetitive theme with layering those eclectic instruments and percussion rhythms he's known for. right, moving on.
Versatility.
Yeah.
He's a pretty versatile composer, despite having these sort of identifiable hallmarks in his sound. And one of the things that I think he's particularly good at is knowing when and where and how to go thematic, and when and where and how to be more atmospheric, and maybe even atonal. I think his, what you would call in the film music lingo, his spotting, his choices of when, what moments I'm going to do what, and how I'm going to approach each individual moment, he's very, very good at that.
Yeah, and you'll get an idea of that in this cue from The Player from 1992, and this is the main title. And this cue just kind of slaps you in the face right away with the kind of frenetic atmosphere he creates with just this mash of crazy rhythms and metallic sounding instrumentations.
Very 90s. It sounds very yeah, 90s to
yeah.
me.
Yeah. And then on the other hand, you have this piece, which is The Player, and it's much more thematic and feels, you know, like it would be part of a different film listening to these two cues side by side. But there's more of a grandiose kind of mysterious feel to this one, with its use of just big strings and sweeping melodies. So here is The Player.
I think you can hear in The Player how the score is influenced by the movie itself, which the movie sort of becomes almost a neo-noir kind of a mystery, even though it's primarily a satire. There's sort of a heavy noirish undercurrent to it. And I think he leans into that, albeit in a way that I sort of described again as very 90s.
Right. Another example here. This is from a series of unfortunate events from 2004. And this cue is called Puttanesca, And here, Newman kind of highlights some of those more quirky atmospherics with pizzicato strings, little shakuhachi flute, solo woodwinds, and little one-note hits here and there with other varied instruments. And then the opposite with this cue, the letter that never came. It becomes much more emotional and bittersweet as we find out, you know, what happens with these characters towards the end of the film. So here is the letter that never came.
And then I just wanted to point out a cue that sort of illustrates how he can be both atmospheric and thematic almost at the same time. So this is a cue from The Green Mile, and it is called The Green Mile. And there's definitely a theme here, but this cue is more about evoking a certain kind of feeling through just this kind of a moody texture. It's more interested in doing that than it is being sort of sweepingly lyrical, even though there is a melody. So here's The Green Mile.
All right, we're going to highlight some of our picks here. We've got a few.
All right, the first score that I wanted to talk about is Angels in America, the HBO prestige miniseries event from, I believe, 2003. And we're going to listen to the main title, which to me is one of Newman's strongest themes. You're going to hear it here presented in kind of an extended, basically like a concert suite kind of a way. And you're definitely going to hear some of his trademark orchestration that we talked about earlier. But for the most part, it's pretty restrained. Like, he's not getting too wild. It's just a very straightforward, but very beautiful theme. So let's listen to the main title from Angels in America.
All right, for my first pick, I'm going back to Road to Perdition. This might be my favorite Thomas Newman score.
It's a good one.
Usually. But anyways, the cue is called Rock Island 1931. And this is just a great example of his creating a cold atmosphere with the lyrical strings and the Illan pipes, which also highlight the Irish family in the film.
My next selection is from The Good German, 2006, and it's a cue that is in German, and I'm not going to attempt to pronounce that, lest I butcher that language. We're just going to call it the main title because it's the main title piece. And this is very much an old-fashioned throwback to classic Hollywood composing. A big, unabashed, not afraid to be in your face, very reminiscent of sort of the noir and even wartime scores of the 1940s. And the movie itself is sort of a pastiche. It's sort of, it's heavily influenced by that era. And you can tell that Thomas Newman, in the parlance of our times, understood the assignment.
And for some reason, the Academy gave Gustavo Santaolalla an Oscar for Babel instead.
Yeah, I mean, at least this was nominated.
Well, it might be one of the least Newman-y scores he's written, I think.
Yeah, he really embraces just the idea of we're going back in time. Because the movie kind of does, too. The script has, you know, some modern edges to it. But the movie, if you're watching the movie as a composer, you're definitely thinking, well, I have to score this like, you know, Max Steiner or Franz Waxman or even, yes, an Alfred Newman.
Oh.
Because it's definitely, with a couple exceptions, this score could have been composed in the 40s. Like, it's that much of a throwback.
All right, jumping ahead. Into the future, we have WALL-E from 2008. And the cue is called Define Dancing. Now, with this cue, we get layers of a lot of interesting percussion elements that create this kind of futuristic texture, while the strings bring out more the romantic elements of the melody. So here is Define Dancing.
Thank you.
This is a very sweet cue, and the whole score is sort of a, I don't know if we'll say a sibling or a cousin to another score that I'm going to talk about shortly. Mm. But before we get there, well, you know me and James Bond.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We have to talk about one of the James Bond scores that Thomas Newman composed. And in this case, I'm going to talk about Spectre. Specifically, you're going to hear from the end titles of Spectre. And in the Bond fan community, Spectre is not a score that is particularly highly regarded. It's the second of the two scores that Thomas Newman wrote for the Bond franchise. He did Skyfall before this. And most people would agree that Skyfall is the superior score. Spectre ended up having a lot of material that was sort of reused from Skyfall, and there are various explanations for why that occurred. Newman has his own explanation for it. Sam Mendes, the director, has one. The editor has another one. They don't all overlap. So we don't know exactly why a lot of Skyfall was repurposed for Spectre, but there is still, you know, plenty of new material that Newman wrote, and particularly the theme that you're going to hear in this end title piece, I think it's kind of the highlight of the Spectre score. And it's the closest that Newman gets in his Bond scores to truly evoking or paying homage to John Barry's string writing. And it definitely feels like he was consciously trying to channel some of Barry's more atmospheric Bond cues through his own style. So let's listen to some of the end title from Spectre.
All right, for my next pick, I am highlighting The Horse Whisperer from 1998, and the cue is called The Rhythm of the Horse. And I would almost classify this as a little bit anachronistic in a way, because it feels like we should be in an English countryside or something. But what I like about this cue is the simplicity of the main theme in the beginning with the woodwinds, and then just how it eventually crescendos into this really gorgeous moment with the strings that kind of suggests vastness or majesty. So here is Rhythm of the Horse.
Thank you.
My next selection is from the score to Passengers from 2016, and it's a cue called Precious Metals. And this is the one that I think is sort of a sibling to WALL-E, because they're both sort of set, at least partially, on large ships in space. And if I were to select like a prototypical or even stereotypical Newman piece, I might choose this one, because this is the sort of sound that is very much what I think of in my mind when I think of a lot of his scores. Very textural. The orchestration and instrumentation feel pretty unique. There's sort of a sense of rhythm that is driving it. That's all there. And it still sounds fresh in this score, despite him having done this basic sort of thing for like 25 years by that point. I like this score a lot. This is, to me, this is a good writing score. So here's Precious Metals from Passengers.
All right, my next pick is from Oscar and Lucinda from 1997, and the cue is called The Church of Glass. And this cue is interesting because it features a choral element that I think is rarely heard in Newman's work. He just creates this triumphant build as the cue progresses with the repeated motif you'll hear at the beginning.
I'd never heard anything from this score. And then I listened to this entire cue and I'm listening to it and it's like, okay, this is interesting. And then it gets really big and it's like, it gets bigger than you usually hear from Newman. And I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of a different gear that I'm not used to hearing from him. And I was impressed. All right. My final pick is from the score to 1917 from 2019. And it's the cue, The Night Window. And, you know, this score is only, I guess, just about 3 years old at this point, but I'm pretty confident this is my favorite Thomas Newman cue of all time now.
Mm-hmm.
it starts in a very almost kind of intimate way. There's like almost this lullaby type motif that is being played on the celeste to set kind of like an ethereal or dreamlike mood. And then the cue just starts to build and build to a much grander sort of scale, accompanying what is, I think, the most visually spectacular scene in the movie. To me, it's the most memorable, like, 3 or 4 minutes of the whole film. This music has intrigue, it's got danger, but there's also kind of this sense of restrained heroism running underneath it as well. And I just think this is spectacular stuff from Thomas Newman. And to me, this is another, you know, instance where he probably should have won the Oscar for this. But so here's The Night Window from 1917.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth there. The rest of the score is okay, but I think this might be one of the most spectacular pieces of the score and that Newman has written in general.
It's sort of the one, it's the one big scene in the movie where the music is allowed to carry it, because there's no dialogue in this scene. It is entirely just music and visuals, and I think it's fantastic.
All right, my final pick is just a short one. It's from Finding Nemo from 2003, and the cue is The Little Clownfish from the Reef. And this is basically the theme, the main theme of the film, Nemo Egg. But it's just one of the simplest themes that just kind of oozes this sense of pride or reverence with it as the strings kind of swell. All right. There you have it, folks.
All right.
We've come to the end of yet another episode, and we thank you for joining us. Be sure to check out our companion playlist for this episode on Spotify. Link is in the show description. And most of the cues that we featured here will be on that list. So enjoy.
Take care.
Bye.